Hello, and welcome to the May 2015 edition of Annotated Bibliography Podcast, also known as Journal Scan or This Month in other journals besides the AJNR that I'm interested in. I'm Jeff Ross, and for this edition, I've selected 8 articles from the recent literature that may be of interest to you. And as always, the references that I'm discussing will be posted on the AJNR blog site, so no need to write anything down. So let's look at the first one. The first paper has a first author of Gregory Kuczynski, and it is entitled 3 Tesla Functional MR Language Mapping Comparison with Direct Cortical Stimulation in Gliomas, and this is from Neurology in 2015, issue 84. The authors evaluated 3T-fMRI language mapping to direct cortical stimulation during awake surgery in 40 patients with supratentorial gliomas, 24 low-grade gliomas and 16 high-grade. They aimed to identify the clinical, histopathologic, and radiologic factors associated with fMRI and direct cortical stimulation discrepancies. 3-block design tasks were performed during fMRI: letter word generation, category word generation, and semantic association. They found that the sensitivity and specificity of fMRI combining the 3 tasks was 37% and 83% respectively. They conclude that although specific 3T-fMRI is currently used in the preoperative workup, is insufficiently sensitive for precise language mapping in patients with gliomas located in eloquent areas. Higher grade tumors and tumors with higher RCBV significantly alter fMRI reliability. fMRI performance varied in this study, with oligodendrogliomas performing poorly, which the authors speculated may reflect neurovascular uncoupling or other parameters such as glutamate recycling or pH modification or lactate production. They also showed a link between tumor grade and fMRI results, with high-grade tumors marginally associated with false negative occurrences. They also found that hyperperfused gliomas with a high tumor RCBV were less likely to have fMRI false positive occurrences. The second paper has a first author of Larry Junk, and it is entitled Resection of Gliomas Around Language Areas. Can fMRI contribute? And that's from Neurology 2015, issue 84. This is an editorial that accompanied the paper that I just talked about and compares and contrasts the strengths and weaknesses of fMRI and direct cortical stimulation. Notable limitations of direct cortical stimulation include the inability of the patients to tolerate the awake evaluation during surgery, limited usefulness when there is underlying moderate or severe language impairment, and the risk of inducing seizures. Test results also vary with the strength of the current used, with lower false negatives with higher current, but with an associated increased risk of seizures. The third paper has a first author of Atul Goel, and it is entitled, Is Atlantoaxial Instability the Cause of Chiari Malformation? Outcome analysis of 65 patients treated by atlantoaxial fixation. This is from Journal of Neurosurgery Spine in 2015, issue 22. The author treated 65 patients over a 3-year period with Chiari malformations. The surgical strategy of atlantoaxial fixation was performed in all cases, regardless of any demonstrable evidence of craniovertebral instability or physical bone or joint abnormality. 55 patients had syringomyelia, and 37 patients had basilar invagination. 63 patients improved after surgery, and the improvement was sustained during the average follow-up period of 18 months. He concludes that the pathogenesis of Chiari malformation with or without associated basilar invagination and or syringomyelia is primarily related to atlantoaxial instability. Now, I don't even know where to go with this paper. I think at a minimum, if you have a journal club, you should tackle the kind of poorly defined methods, the variable patient population, and the somewhat unconventional logic that is employed. The author concludes, Chiari malformations with or without basilar invagination is always associated with instability at the atlantoaxial joint, even if such instability is not clinically manifest or is not demonstrated on radiologic imaging. So I don't even know what that statement means. The instability is present even if it can't be shown in this particular space-time continuum. I tend to think of these patients that he has shown, such as assimilation of C1 with the occiput, basilar invagination, condylar and basio-occipital hypoplasia, as having the primary defect being the congenital bony anatomy, with a secondary inferior displacement of the tonsils due to that abnormal anatomy, and not primarily the abnormality being the Chiari malformation or the descent of the tonsils. Needless to say, this atlantoaxial instability concept is really not mainstream at this point. Number four is associated with this last paper. It has an author of Andrew J, G-A-E-A, and this is an editorial entitled Chiari Malformation 1, Surgically Treated with Atlantoaxial Fixation. This is from Journal of Neurosurgery Spine in 2015, issue 22. So this is an interesting letter to the editor regarding that Goel paper, saying that that paper, quote, challenges conventional theories, close quote. I would certainly agree with that. Current and accepted pediatric neurosurgical literature shows an increased likelihood of fusion for patients in this type of group if they have basilar invagination, a so-called complex Chiari, or maybe colloquially called a Chiari malformation 1.5, or a clival axial angle of less than 125 degrees. And I would agree that those three things do seem to have a reasonable association for increased probability of fusion in the future for these patients. The author also calls the language used in the Goel paper flowery and sophomoric. So between those two papers, that makes rather interesting reading, and I would suggest you take a look at those. The fifth paper has a first author of Yen Lin Huang, and it is entitled Susceptibility-Weighted MRI in Mild Traumatic Brain Injury. And this is from Neurology 2015, issue 84. The authors evaluated the frequency of microbleeds identified by susceptibility-weighted MRI in patients with mild traumatic brain injury and normal controls, and they correlate these findings with neuropsychological tests. They looked at 26 patients with traumatic brain injury and 12 control subjects presenting with microbleeds on susceptibility-weighted MR. The traumatic brain injury group showed more microbleeds in the cortex and subcortical region, and the control group showed more microbleeds in the more central aspects of the brain parenchyma. The TBI patients who had microbleeds had lower digit span scores than the patients with the negative findings. They concluded that the presence of microbleeds could be a possible severity biomarker for minimal traumatic brain injury. They recommend the addition of a susceptibility-weighted MR technique as a complementary sequence to the MRI protocol for patients being evaluated for minimal traumatic brain injury, which will allow a nearly 25% increase in the detection rate of microbleeds. The sixth paper has a first author of Rachel Moses, and it is entitled, Is the Sedimentation Sign Associated with Spinal Stenosis Surgical Treatment Effect in Sport? And that is from Spine 2015, issue 40. Now, the sedimentation sign is the position of the nerve roots within the thecal sac on the axial images. A negative sign being the more normal distribution of the roots into the dependent part of the canal, and a positive sign is showing a more central position of the roots within the thecal sac. This is reflecting the stenosis that is present, which is going to limit the root displacement into the dependent portion of the sac. In this study, the authors evaluated the 654 patients with spinal stenosis enrolled in the Spine Patient Outcomes Research Trial. T2-weighted axial and sagittal digitized images of 115 patients were available for retrospective review. 66% of these patients had a positive sedimentation sign. A positive sign was seen more often with stenosis at L2-3 and correlated with severe central stenosis at two or more levels. A positive sedimentation sign was associated with a small but statistically greater surgical treatment effect for Oswestry Disability Index in patients with symptomatic canal stenosis. So I think every little bit helps, and it's easy enough to evaluate and take a look at where the roots are at, and it's a reasonable addition to the usual morphologic evaluation we perform for canal stenosis. If this helps me in any way to avoid having to measure thecal sac surface area, I'm all for it. I'll stick, however, for the most part, to my mild, moderate, and severe methodology. Seventh paper has the first author of Arya Nuri, and it is entitled Role of Magnetic Resonance Imaging in Predicting Surgical Outcome in Patients with Cervical Spondylotic Myelopathy. This is from Spine in 2015, issue 40. The authors looked at 278 patients with one or more clinical signs of myelopathy, and they underwent decompressive surgery. Complete baseline clinical and MR data were available in 102 patients. Multivariate logistic regression was conducted after a conceptual division of variables into three groups: T1 signal analysis, T2 signal analysis, and anatomical measurements. They found that the baseline clinical score was a strong predictor of post-surgical outcome in cervical spondylotic myelopathy at 6 months. A model inclusive of the maximum canal compromise and T1 hypointensity assessment provided superior predictive capacity. For the maximum canal compromise definition, I would have you see the paper by Failings et al. That was from Spine in 1999. That's issue 24, page 605. The takeaway is that MR has a significant role in predicting patient outcomes. Interesting that the T1 hypointensity provided superior predictive capability versus what we kind of take as useful, which is the intrinsic T2 signal within the cord. The eighth paper has the first author of Sumat Samuel, and it is entitled Subaxial Injury Classification Scoring System Treatment Recommendations. This is from Spine in 2015, issue 40. The authors defined the subaxial injury classification score by reviewing imaging studies and clinical records in 185 patients with subaxial cervical spine trauma presenting to a level 1 spinal injury referral center and correlated them to the treatment decisions and surgical approach. The results showed that 94% of the non-surgically managed patients and 96% of surgically managed patients match the SLIC treatment recommendations. The mean SLIC score of the surgically treated group of patients was higher than that of the non-surgical group. The injury morphology scores were not predictive of surgical approach, but increasing SLIC scores correlated with increasing complexity of treatment. They concluded that the use of this scoring system as an ordinal severity scale has been validated. Now, for more details on this scoring system, I would refer you to the initial paper by Vaccaro et al. That's entitled The Subaxial Cervical Spine Injury Classification System, a Novel Approach to Recognize the Importance of Morphology, Neurology, and Integrity of the Discoligamentous Complex. And this is from Spine in 2007. That's issue 32, and it starts on page 2365. So those are the eight papers that I found somewhat of interest this month. So thanks for sticking with me to the end of this podcast. If you have any feedback, please email me with your constructive criticism or effusive praise. And you can reach me at the email address ajnr.eic@gmail.com. So that's ajnr.e as in echo, I as in India, C as in Charlie, @gmail.com. So till next time, thanks so much for listening.